Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer-engineer Joe Ciccarelli. First of all, for as long as tours have been going out, there's always been a question, is it worth it to be the tour opener? So in other words, the opening act on a big tour. Many tours don't actually have one these days, and in other cases, you have to do a buy-in, meaning that you actually have to pay the act in order to perform. That being said, How Music Charts did a study to find out if opening on a tour really helps your career at all, and if there's any correlation with the number of streams that an opening act might have. They found it was all determined by four different things. First of all, it was the size of the venue. So obviously, if you're going to be touring stadiums and sheds, you're going to get a lot more visibility than you would in smaller clubs. So that makes a big difference. The location of the shows is also a big deal because there are some areas where you may be unknown or your style of music might not be as popular than in other locations. The number of shows is a big deal. So if you just did two or three shows with a big act, it wouldn't mean nearly as much as if you had done the whole tour with them or half a tour with them. So that's a big deal. And finally, you have to be stylistically compatible with the main act. We've all been to concerts where the opening act was so different from the headliner that they just didn't make any sense. They made no connection with the audience. It had nothing to do with whether they're good or bad. It's just that people were expecting a different type of music. If we look back, there are lots of examples of this. One of the biggest ones that I can remember is when Prince opened for the Rolling Stones on a tour, and he was booed off the stage. Just too different. So that's a big deal. So what they found was the likelihood of immediately converting listeners is pretty low. The caveat to that is, if you're on tour for a long stretch of time, then you'll actually see a boost in your streaming numbers. So is this worth doing? Yes, it's worth doing just for the experience and what you're going to learn from an established artist. But any benefits in streaming is going to take some time to realize. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that the fifth edition of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook is now available. It's totally updated and includes new sections on mixing and immersive audio, self-mastering, new mixer interviews, and much more. Get your copy at a special discounted price at bobbyosinski.com/handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. And remember, you can learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. Now, the AES show was recently held in New York City. This was a big deal because it was the first in-person show since 2019. The AES actually shared the floor with the NAB New York show as well. So there are two shows going on at once. The attendance wasn't quite what anybody expected. I think they'll tell you that they really liked the number of people that were there, but in fact, it was lower than most other AES shows in the past. Final attendance was about 7,000 people for the AES, which is maybe a third of what they usually get. And the NAB had 9,500. So you put those two shows together and it was still less than what they're used to getting in one AES show. There are about 100 manufacturers there, but a lot didn't show up. One of the reasons why is that New York is a super expensive show. The union especially makes it difficult, and lodging expenses are really high in the city. One of the big complaints was the fact that there was a big line at registration on the first day, and even if you were pre-registered, it still took an hour to get in, and you would think after all this time, this would be the one place that they'd have it together where that wouldn't happen at all. There are many new products that came out. SSL came out with their M-Box Studio and Origin 16-channel console. Avid came out with its Carbon 8-channel mic pre. Universal and Bach Audio showed four new condenser microphones. There are a few new API modules. And Sony came out with the C80 microphone. So that sounds like a pretty good list of new products. The fact of the matter is, just about everybody knew about these from being online even before the show, so there were really no new surprises. So when you look at this, you think, well, are trade shows doomed? It's not about the new gear anymore, because you really hear about it way before the trade show happens. A lot of it has to do with meeting people there, but that can be done online too. Then there's industry events, and of course that isn't easily replicated online, so that's one positive. And when it comes down to it, I think this is probably more useful for newcomers to the business than for longtime pros. But still, it's nice to see some old friends. And when it comes down to it, that's the best reason to go to a trade show. My guest this week is Joe Ciccarelli, who's a 10-time Grammy-winning producer-engineer-mixer, whose credits include Beck, U2, The White Stripes, Strokes, Killers, Elton John, Morrissey, Jason Mraz, among many, many others. Other projects have included music supervision of films such as Suicide Kings and Men with Guns, the TV series Cracker, and Robert Altman's The Gun. Joe is also the studio designer for the state-of-the-art Royalton Recording Studios, which is now known as Sphere in Burbank, California, and he's served as an A&R consultant for several major and independent labels. Most recently, Leapwing has released his signature plugin that captures Joe's special sounds on the most common mix elements. During the interview, we spoke about working as a music supervisor, the impetus for his signature plugin, the analog gear that the plugin is based on, producing in different genres, and much more. I spoke with Joe via Zoom from a studio at Sunset Sound in Hollywood. You're based out of Sunset Sound these days, right? Well, that's your old haunt.
Yeah, it has been for the last 10, 12 years, something like that. Yeah, you know, I came here, Greg Wells and I did a project together like in 2005 or something, or seven, I can't remember what it was. And we loved the place so much that we ended up coming back here for projects. And then I started coming back here for other projects on my own and, you know, ended up doing so many things here, like Jason Mraz, Young the Giant, My Morning Jacket, just so many different Alanis Morissette, Morrissey, so many things over the years. This has really been my home indeed.
Yeah. Are you mixing there as well?
Yeah. So I've got my little space here. I don't know how much you can see of it, but you know, I've got, I kind of overlooked the parking lot. I don't know if you know Sunset. You know, when you drive in the parking lot there, the studio is, the main studio building is to the left, but straight ahead, there's another couple of houses in there. And there's a few producers in here that have rooms on the lot here. So it's nice. It's a little community here and it's kind of cool.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I understand. So then when you need to track, you just go down the studio.
Yeah, so basically, like all my outboard gear, a lot of my outboard gear is all in Studio One, because Studio One was really my hang for years, but it just got too expensive. Budgets couldn't afford it. No one was willing to pay, you know, $1,500 a day to go in and do a vocal. It wasn't going to happen anymore. So I'll go in there for, you know, a week or two, cut my tracks, then come over here, overdub, mix for whatever it takes to finish the album.
Yeah, but see, you saw what was happening with budgets and you rolled with it. You found a way to make it work.
I don't know. I mean, you got to. It's just sort of like, just the way records are made now. I mean, the good thing is that there's more opportunities. There's more music being made. So, you know, you kind of have to do four times the amount of work because you know, you're in your little space, you're probably not with an assistant or whatever it is. And, you know, you're basically doing the job of two to four people on your own. And yeah, so I come in here and I'm doing vocals, keyboards, guitars, then I'm mixing. And, you know, I mean, it's nice having a space that's yours and, you know, good or bad, you understand the acoustics. It's good. It's good.
I saw something. Oh, I guess it was on your website that you were a music supervisor for film and TV. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, no, I've done that over the years. I haven't done it in a while, but I've done a bunch of films over the years. In fact, I had a company with I don't know if you know Aaron Jacobus and Steve Pross. We had a company for a while doing music supervision, and you know, that was fun. The problem is that now there's so many people in that game that it just became so competitive that it wasn't fun to do it. Like everything, like you know, somebody approached me the other day about doing an Atmos mix, and they were like, we have $500 a song.
Ooh, yeah.
Like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Have you done any Atmos?
No, I really haven't. I've dabbled in it a tiny bit, but look, I love moving forward. I love new formats. I think that, you know, the gaming world has certainly shown us that there's much more to be had with spatial audio. And I think everybody's got to embrace that and move forward in a way, whether or not, I guess I just have some objection to how some of the record companies have gone about doing this, you know, where it's like, let's just mix a glut of stuff. Let's not get in touch with the original producers or artists, or I don't know. That hits me the wrong way. No, it's not worth my time. Not at all. And, you know, especially in my room is tiny and I couldn't properly do it here. If I had a whole speaker set up, I'd still have to go and take the project over to a proper room and check it out and make sure that it's sounding great there. So, you know, by the time you're done, you're basically broke and you've worked 2 weeks on something. And no, I won't do it.
One of the things that I've noticed, and I've been to a lot of playbacks now of rather famous albums that we all know that don't seem to work in Atmos. I mean, EDM works great, but you get something like The Who and it gets spread out and you go, yeah, but now there's no impact like stereo.
No, it's very true. You know, you work so hard on a mix to glue everything together and make it all move together and have this life. And then you pull it all apart and then you have to figure out a way to get that same feeling, but all spread out. It's tough.
Yeah.
You know, like you say, like the energy isn't always the same.
Well, let's get to your plug-in. So,
Yeah.
What was the impetus for that then? What basically made you decide to want to do that?
Yeah. Well, like I said earlier, when the folks at Leapwing talked to me about this, I was super excited to be in that company because I really love all the plugins that they make. I use the Center One and the Stage One and all the time. And plus, they have their signature line with Al Schmidt, and Al was, you know, just the world to me, just the best. And to be a part of that is quite an honor. But more so, I really thought about people getting started and how it's really tough when you get started. I mean, I remember the first sessions, you know, I did as an engineer. You know, what you would do is copy what other engineers' sessions you saw. And, you know, but you never realized that the reason he set it up that way or used that gear was specifically for the type of music and the emotional intention that he had for that piece of music. And it's not about, you know, copying the setups, but it's about really understanding the intent and trying to figure out, you know, what you do for something that's a heavy rock record would be very different from what you do for a jazz record. And you know, always making presets is a very, very difficult thing. But the thing that's happened to me in the last few years, you know, over the years, I've done presets for UA and a number of companies, which, you know, I love to help them out. And, you know, you make presets and you think like, you know, this is all source dependent. So you really can't get something that is going to work 100%. But the thing that shocked me is the amount of people that have come to me and said, oh man, I use your presets all the time. They're really great. I love them for vocal or bass or whatever it is. And I'm like, really, you do? I'm quite shocked. So I thought, okay, so there's some legitimacy here. People are actually getting something out of this. And like I was saying earlier, I think that when you first start out, you know, at some point, you know, you're like, well, it's a kick drum, but where do I go? And, you know, how do I build it? And how do I make room for the bass? And how do I make it work together with the bass? And all those sort of things. So I wanted to give everybody like a platform that they could start with. I think we did a good job, and kudos to Robin and everybody at Leapwing. They really found a way to make the presets such that they really do what they're supposed to do, but also there's a large amount of flexibility there that you can really get in and be somewhat granular and really work on the sounds yourself, but you have a starting point that's pretty impactful. It's a good working tool where, you know, if you're starting a mix and you got a kick drum and you're not sure exactly where to go with it, there's options in there, or if it's a bass guitar or whatever. I think at the very least, it's a starting point where you can go, okay, yeah, it's starting to have some size and punch and it's sitting in the right place in the record now, but I need to tailor it a little bit for my song. So there's a little bit of flexibility there.
What I noticed was it's fairly complex because you have complex signal paths that you like to use with lots of gear, but yet it doesn't come across as that complex unless you really look into it and you go, oh yeah, but there's this, this, and this, and then it goes here. And but on the surface, it's not like that.
Good. Well, that's really good to hear, because it is indeed complex. And you know, especially when it comes to drums, I use a lot of parallels. And that's all built in behind the scenes in the plugin. So if you actually were to break it down, you'd be like, oh my God, he's going to several compressors and a couple of different EQs. And, you know, it's all getting blended together. But yet at the same time, there's enough flexibility there that you can tweak things, but hopefully it's not too overwhelming in terms of the parameters that you can adjust, that you don't get lost in it, that you can really get started with the sounds. And, you know, there, for a number of the sounds, there's a graphic EQ there, and that's a real easy thing to manipulate. And, you know, graphics are indeed graphic, they're visual. And I think for most people, you can get a good picture of where you want to go with the sound.
How long did it take to develop?
You know, it actually took a while, but I will say the one great thing about Leapwing is that once they committed to it, man, they dove in, and, you know, they worked hard for 6-9 months getting this to bring to market now. You know, a lot of these companies, they're like 4 years out. There's other things I've had in development that people are like, yeah, you could, how's early 24? Really? My idea might be old school by that time, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to go there.
Well, considering it's all based on analog gear that you use, right?
Pretty much. Yeah, we took like a lot of my personal gear, as well as the gear here at Sunset Sound, used that, modeled that, basically brought up different sessions. And then in making the presets, I would basically run, you know, a number of different sessions, everything from things that I had recorded to random projects that clients sent me to mix, where things weren't as processed as I might do. Because, you know, I grew up in the, as you did, in the 24-track analog days, where basically you got your sounds on the tracking tape, and it really had to sound like a record. You know, when the producer walked in the room that day with all the band there, it had to sound like it was on the radio, you know?
Yeah.
So you were trying to make a finished product right there at the day of tracking. So I really learned to put all my EQ, compression, delays, et cetera, on right there on the tracking date. So when, you know, musicians walked in after cutting a track, it sounded, you know, 80% of the way to a finished record. So Yeah, so behind the scenes in the plugin, there is all that gear that I would use, whether it were Pultex or Fairchilds or API EQs or whatever, that's all there behind the scenes. My favorite thing about the plugin is that, we did it over here at Sunset Sound on the old Domitio console, and I won't say it's exactly the Domitio console that was used, but because they did tweak it further. But the interesting thing, as you know, about most analog consoles is they really react differently the way you drive them. And, you know, if you hit them hard, it's one sound. If you hit them cold, it's a cleaner, more open sound, less sort of compressed. And so the guys at Leapwing were able to kind of model the line input of that console and capture what that line input level does to the sound of the signal chain. And then they also modified it too with a bunch of different, it's hard to explain, but they modified it in a way that there is definitely a character knob. You know, it's sort of my favorite knob in the plugin is the drive knob, because, you know, an EQ, you know what an EQ does, compressor does what it's supposed to do, unless you really drive it differently hard. But the drive seems to react very differently to different instruments at different levels. And I love that. I found that it's almost like having yet another type of EQ to choose from, because just the way you kind of push the plug in. And I tend now to, being all in the box, I tend to sometimes really saturate things digitally, really distort them and give them a character, especially with rock music where you want things aggressive. Digital distortion has its own flavor and it can be really pretty intense. So sometimes I'll deliberately digitally distort things and then bring the levels down to where they're manageable, but getting that extra crunch and attack edge sometimes gives things a lot of personality. So I'm not afraid of distorting things or saturating things. And you can do that in the plugin as well. So there's really, you know, I think you can take it as far as you'd like to take it, but know that behind the scenes, there might be 10 different devices that are really working as if I were sitting at the console with 4 different parallels on drums or 2 different ones on bass, or in the case of vocals, sometimes it's multiple compressors and EQs. So, you got a lot to work there. It's like having, 6 or 8 plugins in a chain in one instance.
That being said, there's so much music these days that is made up of loops, made up of samples. So for instance, you'd get a drum loop where, it'd be stereo and the whole drum loop would be there. I always get asked about this. So this is the way I work. What do I do? Are there presets for that?
For actually loops specifically? No, right? The basic initial plugin is going to come with drums, bass, guitar, piano, vocal, just the sort of basics, if you will, rhythm section. What they're planning to do is every month or every 3 months release a different set of plugins that would be more instruments, different types of music, just more things to choose from. I think that having the presets to choose from is great, but the thing we were afraid of was initially overwhelming people, that if they had a dozen kick drum plugins, they might get lost just in the presets, let alone, wanting to put other plugins in the chain. So we've sort of thought we'd streamline it in the first issue of the plugin. And then as things go along, there'll be more presets. In fact, what we're trying to do, and probably Robin will kill me, by telling you this, but what I really want to do is have my friends do presets on top of my presets. In other words, to take my presets and tweak them to their liking, whether it's for the style of music they do or just their own personal tastes. So we're hoping that what we can do in further issues of the plugin is offer the Dave Pensado version, the Nico Bolas version, or whatever it might be, where somebody can go in and go, okay, I like what he's doing here with the bass, but you know, for me, I think it's got to be a little brighter to cut through the track. Or, you know, when I do kind of R&B music, I want it to be a little more scooped out and that kind of thing. So I'm hoping that what you see is in the future, there'll be multiple packages that you'll get for the plugin where you'll have various styles of music and various other engineers and producers contributing to it. I want to call it reset my preset.
I love it. So. I love it. What are the reverbs based on?
Ah, good question. A number of things. Classic EMT plate, a live chamber here at Sunset. Although once again, things are indeed tweaked a little bit. There's also AMS reverb in there as well. And, you know, they're my settings on all this sort of stuff. They have pre-delays and sometimes feedback and really, really kind of tweak to the way I might do it in a session. So you really do have, you know, a number of, you know, what might take you six plugins on an instrument is kind of all there in one.
So when you're mixing and you're in your room there, I take it you're mostly in the box.
Pretty much. I have a analog stereo bus chain that I use. So I have a Burl summing network and a Burl A to D. So basically everything goes through my analog summing and then out through Curve Bender and Shadow Hills and SSL, whatever it might be for the material. And but all my balancing, all my EQ compression, etc., is all plugins. Occasionally I'll use hardware inserts for a reverb, something like that. Just because of the recallability, it's all in the box. I mean, everything these days, every project people want to tweak and tweak and tweak. And you know, the days when you and I started, it was sort of like, you know, if you were mixing an album and it was 10 songs, you were in the studio for 10 days, you were done, and that's it. But now, you know, a mix on an album can take 3 to 6 months because people are constantly, you know, trying to revise this and tweak this. And, you know, the A&R guy wants this, the manager wants this, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, besides revisions, though, how long does it take you on a mix now before you get to revision stage?
You know, it takes me at least a couple of days. I'm slow. You know, if I'm setting it all up myself, you know, it's a number of hours just to get it set up in a form that, you know, the labeling is right. And then, you know, I'll dig into it for a while and I might get bored or tired or feel like I'm kind of getting too myopic and need a little break, and then I'll come back to it. But it's usually, you know, a day and a half to 2 days before I send it out to the artist. And then from there, it's whatever tweaks they want to make. And hopefully it's not too many revisions. Usually it's a couple. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, really minimum an album is taking me 20 days, you know. So I'm pretty much, you know, if I'm mixing an album, it's really a month of my time when it's done. By the time you send it out, get all the files printed, etc., send it out. And it's just me because I'm picky and slow and just in my own space and, you know, want to revisit things. And, you know, then I'll sometimes feel like, well, you know what, now that I got a flow going on, I should go back to the first tune and see if I can make the first tune fit a little better with these others because you kind of refine their direction and overall sound as you go along.
Yeah, well, we talked about loops before. Are you getting any kind of music like that that's loop-based?
Not that much stuff. I mean, I've done some electronic things and recently just did something with Little Dragon. It was all electronic. But in terms of like, you know, sort of dance stuff that's loops, you mean like loops as in the Avalanches, like, you know, where they've taken something off of vinyl and turned it into the drum track?
Yeah.
No, not that much. I mean, that's kind of fun. I love doing that stuff. But I haven't done it. It seemed like late 90s, early 2000s, that was a thing, you know, but not too much now. You know, usually it's some elements are programmed or sampled. I mean, I'm always putting samples in with my drums. You know, people want that consistency of tone and they want the impact. And, you know, we're used to MIDI drums and, you know, MIDI sounds are basically like compressed sounds. And I think everybody wants that kind of tone to their mix where the drums sit there and every beat is constant and big and powerful. So I'm always kind of layering things with samples.
Yeah, everything has changed. I mean, back when bands were tracking in the studio, there was changes in intensity that you got from the band dynamics. And now it's one dynamic and you change it by just adding multiple parts or taking them away. So it's completely right. Different than it used to be.
Oh, very, very true. You definitely. I mean, you know, a lot of the music that I produce is still a large element live players, but you're right. It's a subtractive thing as opposed to a dynamic that comes from a human that you know, I even find that part of my mixing process, I'm actually, in a sense, layering my mix, getting my mix dynamics by adding additional compressors as I go along. Not necessarily on the stereo bus, but like I might have a drum sound that works for the verse. And then at the chorus, I'll add another compressor and, you know, make the drum sound fatter for the chorus as if the guy were hitting harder or the kick and snare at least were dug into more, whatever it is. So I kind of feel like you're right. The process is almost an electronic additive or subtractive process that it's never anybody plays quieter. Yeah. It's kind of either on and off dynamics, you know?
And it's the same with tempo. The tempo is so steady. I do what makes a song a hit for my subscribers. So I take, you know, a song might be whatever is hot today, or it might be an old song. And there was a couple that I came across that were big hits. One was Goodbye Stranger from Supertramp way back when. And when you listen to it, the tempo starts at like 120 and it ends at 129. And it's not because the players were out of control.
It was because that was the intention.
That was the intention. And when it picks up to 129 at the end, the excitement went way up. And it's like, wow, this is why this feels so good.
Exactly. I mean, God, listen to any Dylan song.
Yeah.
You know, listen to anything from that era. Yeah, things got more intense, you know, in the choruses and opened up and got spacious in the verse. And yeah, I won't say that's a thing of the past, but I think it's less important. Less a part of most music now, certainly pop music, you know. Pop music, hip hop music is all so programmed and all about consistent beats and intensity and power and being, you know, all there loud at every moment.
When you're producing, you actually go across genres quite a lot. Is that hard for you?
No, it's actually great. It's a great, really great challenge. It keeps me kind of excited. You know, it's a whole new ball game. I mean, next week I'm doing something that's very sort of rock, but in a very 90s sort of way where, I don't know, just recently I did something that was much more retro and blues and R&B flavored, almost I don't want to say Amy Winehouse, but you know, it had a retro kind of element to it. So that's the challenge to me, is kind of, you know, wearing different suits and kind of diving into that world for 3 months or whatever it takes you on the project. And then, you know, the next project is something different, and you really get to dive into a world where, you know, it's all about heavy high gain guitars, where the last album you were using a Fender Champ or whatever it was. So that's pretty fun.
But that being said, does it take you any time to kind of get into the new genre?
It definitely, it's nothing that you can kind of switch on and off. It really does. It takes a little time to sort of put that suit of clothes on and understand what you're living in, and it being true to that, you know. But the good thing is that sometimes all those influences from other things, in other words, you know, the hard rock project that you just lived for the last 3 months, and then your next project is some folk singer, you know, I think you then go, well, this feels timid and small, and I gotta toughen this up. I gotta put some life in it. So I almost think, in a way, you sort of suddenly cross-pollinize things and really make for something more interesting, because you bring all those influences in. And from my ear, the best records, the best artists are the ones that sort of borrow from a lot of different genres, a lot of different styles, and find a way to make this melting pot and make it their own unique thing, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's part of the magic of it.
When you're tracking, when you're producing, you're not doing the engineering yourself, right? You bring somebody in.
Sometimes I do, most of the time, and a lot of it's because of budgeting. I'll do it myself. But, you know, it really depends on the project. There have been times where, for instance, I've done a number of jazz albums, and I might feel like I might not be the right guy for this. You know, my approach might be a little heavy-handed. So I want to get somebody to work with who's a more traditional kind of engineer and understands the sounds for the music, where I might come in and just tweak it a little too much. So it's been fun for me to work with people and you know, get a little outside perspective on things, you know?
Yeah. When you're tracking, are you always using the same gear?
Mm-mm. I mean, you know, as much as I'll work in the same room here at Sunset, and I often work at other studios, be it Blackbird in Nashville or, I don't know, Electric Lady or whatever, I almost deliberately try to change things up every project, whether it's different drum mics, different guitar mics. Certainly, I'm looking for different sounds in my head. I'm kind of, you know, one project might want a slicker, brighter sound. Next project might want something that's heavier on the low end and darker overall. So I might be using more ribbon mics for that and less microphones for that, where, you know, the harder rock thing I'll do next week, I'll probably use more microphones on the drums, and I'll probably use brighter microphones. You know, typically I might use just a mono 47 or mono C37A as a drum overhead for something that's more groove oriented. But for a heavy rock thing, I'll probably have a pair of overheads that are brighter, more hi-fi, more detailed. And then I might have Coles or something as well to capture a bit of a kind of compressed drum tone. So, you know, I'll change up my microphones, change up how I treat the room mics, definitely, you know, different compressors will get used. Yeah, I mean, I would say every project, at least 20% of the setup is different.
I like to hear that.
Yeah. Now, you know, we all have our go-to things, you know, our compressors we like, or our mics we like, or, you know, the favorite part of the room for the drums and things like that. So there's things that are consistent, but I will try things a lot with room mics. You know, sometimes it might be a pair of Coles in the middle of the room. Other times it's 87s at the back end of the room. Most of the time there's some stereo ribbon in front of the drum kit, or maybe even for heavier stuff, something close to the floor to get a little bit more kind of air in the low end. So yeah, it just really depends on the music and kind of what I'm hearing for it.
Okay, last question, Joe.
Yeah.
What's the one thing that people don't know about what you do that you wish they did?
I don't know if I wish they would know about it. It's because it's the amount of time that I'll put in before and after the workday. In other words, before I even start the project, I'll really do a lot of research. I don't know, perhaps listening to the artist's last few albums or listening to demos and making notes. I try not to listen to demos too much because I don't want to get tied into them. I want to, you know, have some spontaneity there and some freshness and objectivity. So I don't want to listen to people's demos too much because, you know, as you just get married to parts, and it might be the parts are really bad, but you've just heard them about 1,000 times and they become the song. So I try not to do too much of that, but I'm really always planning things out and thinking, and the end of the day, I'm thinking, okay, what went right? What went wrong? What do I need to fix later? Where can this go? And how much further can I take this record? Or have I taken it too far? And do I have to dial it back? So it's not like you go in the studio for 8-10 hours and that's the end of it. You know, when I dive into a project, it becomes, you know, 7 days a week, your entire life. You wake up in the middle of the night going, I know how to fix this problem. I got it.
You can find out more about Joe at joeciccarelli.com. That's Joe Ciccarelli, ciccarelli.com. You can also find out about his signature plugin at leapwing.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Remember that you can learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to the episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it in Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.